Side 2. That was my cue, of course, to regale them with a few domestic anecdotes of Russia and its primitive ways, which went down well, with the Queen nodding approval and saying, "How barbarous! How strange!" while Elspeth glowed to see her hero holding the floor. Albert joined in his rib-tickling way, to observe that no European state offered such fertile soil for the seeds of socialism as Russia did, and that he feared that the new Tsar had little intellect or character. "So Lord Granville says," was the Queen's prim rejoinder, "but I do not think it is quite his place to make such observations on a royal personage. Do you not agree, Mrs. Flashman?"
Old Ellenborough, who was a cheery, boozy buffer, said to me that he hoped I'd try to civilize the Russians a little by teaching them cricket, and Albert, who had no more humor than the parish trough, looked stuffy and says, "I am sure Colonel Flashman would do no such thing. I cannot understand this passion for cricket. It seems to me a great waste of time. What is the profit to a young boy in crouching motionless in a field for hours on end? Am I not right, Colonel?"
"Well, sir," says I, "I've looked out in the deep field myself long enough to sympathize with you. It's a great fag, to be sure, but perhaps when the boy's a man, his life may depend on crouching motionless behind a Khyber rock or a Burmese bush, so a bit of practice may not come amiss when he's young." Which was sauce, if you like, but I could never resist the temptation in groveling to Albert to put a pinch of pepper down his shirt. It was in my character of bluff, no-nonsense Harry, too, and a nice reminder of the daring deeds I'd done. Ellenborough said, "Hear, hear!" and even Albert looked only half sulky, and said all discipline was admirable, but there must be better ways of instilling it. The Prince of Wales, he said, should not play cricket, but some more constructive game. After that we had tea, very informal, and Elspeth distinguished herself by actually prevailing on Albert to eat a cucumber sandwich. She'll have him in the bushes in a minute, thinks I, and on that happy note our first visit concluded, with Elspeth going home on a cloud to Abergeldy. But if it was socially useful, it wasn't much of a holiday, although Elspeth revelled in it. She went for walks with the Queen twice, calling themselves Mrs. Fitzjames and Mrs. Marmion, if you please, and even made Albert laugh when charades were played in the evening by impersonating Helen of Troy with a Scotch accent. I couldn't even get a grin out of him. We went shooting with the other gentlemen, and it was purgatory having to stalk at his pace. He was keen as mustard, though, and slaughtered stags like a ghazi on hashish. You'll hardly credit it, but his notion of sport was that a huge long trench should be dug so that we could sneak up on the deer unobserved. He'd have done it, too, but the local gillies showed so much disgust at the idea that he dropped it. He couldn't understand their objections, though. To him, all that mattered was killing the beasts. For the rest, he prosed interminably and played German music on the piano, with me applauding like hell. Things weren't made easier by the fact that he and Victoria weren't getting on too well just then. She had just discovered, and confided to Elspeth, that she was in foal for the 9th time, and she took her temper out on dear Albert. The trouble was he was so bloody patient with her, which can drive a woman to fury faster than anything I know. And he was always right, which was worse. So they weren't dealing at all well, and he spent most of the daylight hours tramping up Glen Bollocks, or whatever they call it, roaring, "The gun!" and butchering every animal in view. The only thing that seemed to cheer up the Queen was that she was marrying off her oldest daughter, Princess Vicky, the best of the whole family, in my view, a really pretty, green-eyed little mischief. She was to wed Frederick William of Prussia, who was due at Balmoral in a few weeks, and the Queen was full of it, Elspeth told me. However, enough of the court gossip. It will give you some notion of the trivial way in which I was being forced to pass my time, toadying Albert, and telling the Queen how many acute accents there were on Determine. The trouble with this kind of thing is that it dulls your wits and your proper instinct for self-preservation, so that if a blow falls, you're caught clean offside, as I was on the night of September the 22nd, 1856. I recollect the date absolutely because it was the day after Florence Nightingale came to the castle. I'd never met her, but as the leading Crimean on the premises, I was summoned to join in the tête-à-tête she had with the Queen in the afternoon. It was a frost, if you like. Pious platitudes from the two of them, with Flashy passing the muffins and joining in when called on to agree that what our wars needed was more sanitation and texts on the wall of every dressing station.
There was one near facer for me, and that was when Miss Nightingale, a cool piece that, asked me, calm as you like, what regimental officers could do to prevent their men from contracting certain indelicate social infections from female camp followers of a certain sort. I near as damn it put my teacup in the Queen's lap, but recovered to say that I'd never heard of any such thing, not in the light cavalry anyway. French troops are another matter, of course. Would you believe it, I actually made her blush, but I doubt if the Queen even knew what we were talking about. For the rest, I thought La Nightingale was a waste of good womanhood. Handsome face, well set up and titted out, but with that cold don't-lay-a-lecherous-limb-on-me-my-lad look in her eye. The kind, in short, that can be all right if you're prepared to spend time and trouble making 'em cry Roger, but I seldom have the patience. Anywhere else I might have taken a squeeze at her, just by way of research, but Queen's drawing-room cramps your style. Perhaps it's a pity I didn't. Being locked up for indecent assault on a national heroine couldn't have been worse than the ordeal that was to begin a few hours later. Elspeth and I spent the following evening at a birthday party at one of the big houses in the neighbourhood. It was a cheery affair, and we didn't leave till close on midnight to drive back to Abergeldy. It was a close, thundery night, with big raindrops starting to fall. But we didn't mind. I'd taken enough drink on board to be monstrously horny, and if the drive had been longer and Elspeth's crinoline less of a hindrance, I'd have had at her on the carriage seat. She got out at the lodge, giggling and squeaking, and I chased her through the front door. And there was the messenger of doom, waiting in the hall. A tall chap, almost a swell, but with a jaw too long and an eye too sharp. Very respectable, with a hard hat under his arm and a billy in his hip pocket, I'll wager. I know a genteel strong man from a government office when I see one. He asked could he speak to me, so I took my arm from Elspeth's waist, patted her towards the stairs with a whispered promise that I'd be up directly to sound the charge, and told him to state his business. He did that smart enough. "I am from the Treasury, Colonel Flashman," says he. "My name is Hutton. Lord Palmerston wishes to speak with you." It took me flat aback, slightly foxed that I was. My first thought was that he must want me to go back to London, but then he said, "His lordship is at Balmoral, sir. If you will be good enough to come with me, I have a coach." But, you said Lord Palmerston? The prime... What the deuce? Palmerston wants me?
At once, sir, if you please. The matter is urgent.
Well, I couldn't make anything of it. I never doubted it was genuine. As I've said, the man in front of me had authority written all over him. But it's a fair start when you come rolling innocently home and are told that the first statesman of Europe is round the corner and wants you at the double. And now the fellow was positively ushering me towards the door. "Hold on," says I. "Give me a moment to change my shoes." What I wanted was a moment to put my head in the washbowl and think. And despite his insistence, I snapped at him to wait and hurried upstairs. What the devil was Pam doing here? And what could he want with me? I'd only met him once for a moment before I went to the Crimea. I'd leered at him ingratiatingly at parties, too, but never spoken. And now he wanted me urgently. Me, a mere colonel on half pay. I'd nothing on my conscience either, leastways not to interest him. I couldn't see it, but there was nothing but to obey, so I went to my dressing-room, fretting, donned my hat and topcoat against the worsening weather, and remembered that Elspeth, poor child, must even now be waiting for her cross-buttocking lesson. Well, it was hard lines on her, but duty called, so I just popped my head round her door to call a chaste farewell, and there she was, damn it, reclining languorously on the coverlet like one of those randy classical goddesses, wearing nothing but the big ostrich plume fan I'd brought her from Egypt, and her sniggering maid turning the lamp down low. Elspeth, clothed, could stop a monk in his tracks. Naked and pouting expectantly over a handful of red feathers, she'd have made the Grand Inquisitor burn his books. I hesitated between love and duty for a full second, and then... "The hell with Palmerston, let him wait," cries I, and was plunging for the bed before the Abigail was fairly out of the room. Never miss the chance, as the Duke used to say.
"Lord Palmerston, who, Harry, what do you mean?"
"Never mind," cries I, taking hold and bouncing away.
"But, Harry, oh, such impatience, my love, and dearest, you're wearing your hat."
"The next one's going to be a boy, damn it."
and for a few glorious stolen moments I forgot Palmerston and minions in the hall, and marvelled at the way that superb idiot woman of mine could keep up a stream of questions while performing like a harem houri. We were locked in an astonishing embrace on her dressing-table stool, I recall, when there was a knock on the door, and the maid's giggling voice piped through to say that the gentleman downstairs was getting impatient and would I be long. "Tell him I'm just packing my baggage," says I. "I'll be down directly." And presently, keeping my mouth on hers to stem her babble of questions, I carried my darling tenderly back to the bed. Always leave things as you would wish to find them. "I cannot stay longer, my love," I told her. "The Prime Minister is waiting." And with bewildered entreaties pursuing me, I skipped out, trousers in hand, made a hasty toilet on the landing, panted briefly against the wall, and then stepped briskly down. It's a great satisfaction, looking back, that I kept the government waiting in such a good cause, and I set it down here as a deserved tribute to the woman who was the only real love of my life, and as the last pleasant memory I was to have for a long time ahead. It's true enough, too, as Kodali's daughter taught me, that there's nothing like a good rattle for perking up an edgy chap like me. It had shaken me for a moment, and it still looked rum that Palmerston should want to see me, but as we bowled through the driving rain to Balmoral, I was telling myself that there was probably nothing in it after all, considering the good odour I stood in just then, hobnobbing with royalty and being admired for my Russian heroics. It was far more likely to be fair news than foul. And it wasn't like being bidden to the presence of one of your true ogres, like the old Duke, or Bismarck, or Dr. Roth of God Arnold. I have knocked tremulously on some fearsome doors in my time, I can tell you. No, Pam might be an impatient old tyrant when it came to bullying foreigners and sending warships to deal with the Dagos, but everyone knew he was a decent, kindly old sport at bottom, who put folk at their ease and told a good story. Why, it was notorious that the reason he wouldn't live at Downing Street but on Piccadilly was that he liked to ogle the good-lookers from his window and wave to the cads and crossing-sweepers, who loved him because he talked plain English and would stump up a handsome subscription for an old beaten prize-pug like Tom Sayers. That was Pam. And if anyone ever tells you that he was a politically unprincipled old scoundrel who carried things with a high and reckless hand, I can only say that it didn't seem to work a whit worse than the policies of more high-minded statesmen. The only difference I ever saw between them and Pam was that he did his dirty work barefaced, when he wasn't being deeper than damnation, and grinned about it. So I was feeling pretty easy as we covered the 3 miles to Balmoral, and even pleasantly excited, which shows you how damned soft and optimistic I must have grown. I should have known that it's never safe to get within range of princes or prime ministers. When we got up to the castle, I followed Hutton smartly through a side door, up some back stairs, and along to heavy double doors where a burly civilian was standing guard. I gave my whiskers a martial twitch as he opened the door, and stepped briskly in. You know how it can be when you enter a strange room. Everything can look as safe and merry as ninepence, and yet there's something in the air that touches you like an electric shock. It was here now, a sort of bristling excitement that put my nerves on edge in an instant. And yet there was nothing out of the ordinary to see, just a big, cheerful panelled room with a huge fire roaring under the mantel, a great table littered with papers, and 2 sober chaps bustling about it under the direction of a slim young fellow, Barrington, Palmerston's secretary. And over by the fire were 3 other men. Ellenborough, with his great flushed face and his belly stuck out, a slim, keen-looking old file whom I recognised as Wood of the Admiralty, and with his back to the blaze and his coat-tails up, the man himself, peering at Ellenborough with his bright, short-sighted eyes, and looking as though his dyed hair and whiskers had just been rubbed with a towel, old Squire Pam as ever was. As I came in, his brisk, sharp voice was ringing out. He never gave a damn who heard him. "So, if he's to be Prince Consort, it don't make a ha'porth of difference, you see. Not to the country or me. However, as long as Her Majesty thinks it does, that's what matters, what? Haven't you found that telegraph of Quilter's yet, Barrington? Well, look in the Persian packet there." And then he caught sight of me and frowned, sticking out his long lip. "Ah, that's the man," cries he. "Come in, sir, come in." What with the drink I'd taken and my sudden nervousness, I tripped over the mat, which was an omen, if you like, and came as near as a toucher to oversetting a chair. "By George," says Pam, "is he drunk? All these young fellows are nowadays. Here, Barrington, see him to a chair before he breaks a window. There, at the table." Barrington pulled out a chair for me, and the three at the fireplace seemed to be staring ominously at me while I apologized and took it, especially Pam in the middle, with those bright, steady eyes taking in every inch of me as he nursed his port glass and stuck a thumb into his fob, for all the world like the marshal of a Kansas trail town surveying the street. Which is what he was, of course, on a rather grand scale. He was very old at this time, with the gout and his false teeth forever slipping out, but he was evidently full of ginger tonight, and not in one of his easy-going moods. He didn't beat about, either. "Young Flashman," growls he. "Very good. Staff colonel on half pay at present, what? Well, from this moment you're back on the full list, and what you hear in this room tonight is to go no further, understand? Not to anyone, not even in this castle. You follow?" I followed, sure enough. What he meant was that the Queen wasn't to know. It was notorious that he never told her anything. But that was nothing. It was his tone and the solemn urgency of his warning that put the hairs up on my neck. "Very good," says he again. "Now then, before I talk to you, Lord Ellenborough has something to show you. Wants your opinion of it. All right, Barrington, I'll take that Persian stuff now while Colonel Flashman looks at the damned buns." I thought I'd misheard him as he limped past me and took his seat at the table head, pawing impatiently among his papers. But, sure enough, Barrington passed over to me a little lead biscuit box, and Ellenborough, seating himself beside me, indicated that I should open it. I pushed back the lid, mystified, and there, in a rice-paper wrapping, were three or four greyish, stale-looking little scones, no bigger than Captain's biscuits. "There," says Pam, not looking up from his papers. "Don't eat them. Tell his lordship what you make of those." I knew right off. That faint eastern smell was unmistakable, but I touched one of them to make sure. "They're chapatis, my lord," says I, astonished. "Indian chapatis." Ellenborough nodded. "Ordinary cakes of native food. You attach no signal or significance to them, though." "Why, no, sir." Wood took a seat opposite me. "And you can conjecture no situation, Colonel," says he, in his dry, quiet voice, "in which the sight of such cakes might occasion you alarm." Obviously, ministers of the Crown don't ask damn-fool questions for nothing, but I could only stare at him. Pam, apparently deep in his papers at the table-head, wheezing and sucking his teeth and muttering to Barrington, paused to grunt, "So the damn thing is at dinner, and they'd alarm me," and Ellenborough tapped the biscuit-box. "These chapatis came last week from India, by fast steam sloop, sent by our political agent at a place called Jhansi. Know it? It's down below the Jumna, in Maharatta country. For weeks now, scores of such cakes have been turning up among the sepoys of our native Indian garrison at Jhansi. Not as food, though. It seems the sepoys pass them from hand to hand as tokens."
"Have you ever heard of such a thing?"
Wood interrupted. I hadn't, so I just shook my head and looked attentive, wondering what the devil this was all about, while Ellenborough went on, "Our political knows where they come from, all right. The native village constables, you know, the chowkidars, bake them in batches of 10 and send one apiece to 10 different sepoys, and each sepoy is bound to make 10 more and pass them on to his comrades and so on, ad infinitum. It's not new, of course. Ritual cake passing is very old in India. But there are three remarkable things about it. Firstly, it happens only rarely. Second, even the natives themselves don't know why it happens, only that the cakes must be baked and passed. And third," he tapped the box again, "they believe that the appearance of the cakes foreshadows terrible catastrophe." He paused, and I tried to look impressed, for there was nothing out of the way in all this, straight from Alice in Wonderland, if you like, but when you know India and the amazing tricks the niggers can get up to, usually in the name of religion, you cease to be surprised.
It seemed an interesting superstition, but what was more interesting was that two ministers of the government and a former Governor-General of India were discussing it behind closed doors and had decided to let Flashy into the secret.
"But there's something more," Ellenborough went on, "which is why Skeen, our political man at Jhansi, is treating the matter as one of urgency. Cakes like these have circulated among native troops, quite apart from civilians, on only three occasions in the past 50 years. At Vellore in 06, at Buxar, and at Barrackpore. You don't recall the names? Well, at each place, when the cakes appeared, the same reaction followed among the sepoys." He put on his House of Lords face and said impressively, "Mutiny." Looking back, I suppose I ought to have thrilled with horror at the mention of the dread word, but in fact all that occurred to me was the facetious thought that perhaps they ought to have varied the sepoys' rations. I didn't think much of the political man Skeen's judgment either. I'd been a political myself, and it's part of the job to scream at your own shadow. But if he or Ellenborough, who knew India outside in, was smelling a sepoy revolt in a few mouldy biscuits, well, it was ludicrous. I knew John Sepoy, we all did, didn't we, for the most loyal ass who ever put on uniform, and so he should have been, the way the company treated him. However, it wasn't for me to venture an opinion in such august company, particularly with the Prime Minister listening. He'd pushed his papers aside and risen, and was pouring himself some more port. "Well, now," says he briskly, taking a hearty swig and rolling it round his teeth, "you've admired his lordship's cakes. What damned unappetizing they look, too. All right, Barrington, your assistants can go. Our special leaves at 4, does it? Very well." He waited till the junior secretaries had gone, muttered something about ungodly hours and the Queen's perversity in choosing a country retreat at the North Pole, and paced stiffly over to the fire, where he set his back to the mantel and glowered at me from beneath his gorse-bush brows, which was enough to set my dinner circulating in the old accustomed style. "Tokens of revolution in an Indian garrison," says he. "Very good. Been reading that report of yours again, Flashman. The one you made to Dalhousie last year, in which you described the discovery you made while you were a prisoner in Russia about their scheme for invading India while we were busy in Crimea. Of course, we say nothing about that these days. Peace signed with Russia, all good fellowship and be damned, etc. Don't have to tell you. But something in your report came to mind when this cake business began." He pushed out his big lip at me. "You wrote that the Russian march across the Indus was to be accompanied by a native rising in India, fomented by Tsarist agents. Our politicals have been chasing that fox ever since, picking up some interesting scents, of which these infernal buns are the latest. Now then," he settled himself, eyes half shut, but watching me, "tell me precisely what you heard in Russia, touching on an Indian rebellion. Every word of it." So I told him, exactly as I remembered it, how Scott East and I had lain quaking in our nightshirts in the gallery at Starotorsk, and overheard about Item 7, which was the Russian plan for an invasion of India. They'd have done it too, but Yakub Beg's riders scuppered their army up on the Sir Daria, with Flashy running about roaring with a bellyful of bang, performing unconscious prodigies of valour. I'd set it all out in my report to Dalhousie, leaving out the discreditable bits. You can find those in my earlier memoirs along with the licentious details. It was a report of nicely judged modesty, that official one, calculated to convince Dalhousie that I was the nearest thing to Hereward the Wake he was ever likely to meet. And why not? I'd suffered for my credit. But the information about an Indian rebellion had been slight. All we'd discovered was that when the Russian army reached the Khyber, their agents in India would rouse the natives, and particularly John Company's sepoys, to rise against the British. I didn't doubt it was true at the time. It seemed an obvious ploy. But that was more than a year ago, and Russia was no threat to India any longer, I supposed. They heard me out in a silence that lasted a full minute after I'd finished. And then Wood says quietly, "It fits, my lord." "Too damned well," says Pam, and came hobbling back to his chair again. It's all pat. You see, Flashman, Russia may be spent as an armed power for the present, but that don't mean she'll leave us at peace in India, what? This scheme for a rebellion. By George, if I were a Russian political, invasion or no invasion, I fancy I could achieve something in India, given the right agents. Couldn't I just, though? He growled in his throat, heaving restlessly and cursing his gouty foot. Do you know, there's an Indian superstition that the British Raj will come to an end exactly 100 years after the Battle of Plassey? He picked up one of the chapatis and peered at it. Damn thing isn't even sugared. Well, the 100th anniversary of Plassey falls next June, the 23rd. Interesting. Now then, tell me, what do you know about a Russian nobleman called Count Nicholas Ignatieff?
He shot it at me so abruptly that I must have started a good 6 inches. There's a choice collection of ruffians whose names you can mention if you want to ruin my digestion for an hour or two. Charity Spring and Bismarck, Rudy Starnberg and Wesley Hardin, for example. But I'd put N.P. Ignatieff up with the leaders any time. He was the brute who nearly put pay to me in Russia, a gotch-eyed, freezing ghoul of a man who dragged me halfway to China in chains and threatened me with exposure in a cage and knouting to death and like pleasantries. I hadn't cared above half for the conversation thus far, with its bloody mutiny cakes and the sinister way they kept dragging in my report to Dalhousie, but at the introduction of Ignatieff's name, my bowels began to play the Hallelujah chorus in earnest. It took me all my time to keep a straight face and tell Pam what I knew, that Ignatieff had been one of the late Tsar's closest advisers, and that he was a political agent of immense skill and utter ruthlessness. I ended with a reminiscence of the last time I'd seen him, under that hideous row of gallows at Fort Rahim. Ellenborough exclaimed in disgust, Wood shuddered delicately, and Pam sipped his port.
End of side 2.